Welcome back to another episode of the Religious Studies Project. I am Christopher Cotter. He is
David Robertson.
We are here sitting in a seminar room at the University of Edinburgh, and we are introducing our latest podcast, which is a roundtable discussion that David recorded in Milton Keynes at the BASR conference. It's a roundtable on the study of non-ordinary realities. I'm going to say the names. Fiona Bowie, Bettina Schmidt, David Wilson, David Robertson, Jonathan Tuckett. Did he miss anyone there?
I don't think so. Well, unless there was any beings there that we weren't aware of.
Hey, so if you hear any noises in the background, maybe David could put in some sort of... Oh dear. We've started well. Anyways, take it away, David, and everyone in Milton Keynes.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. I'm pleased to be bringing you today a roundtable, which we've managed to pull together in the last second, based on the panel that Bettina Schmidt and David Wilson, a series of panels actually, put together on the theme of non-ordinary realities. Is that right? Have I got that
and
right?
Methodologies of exploring them.
Yeah. So in a minute, I'm going to ask maybe ask Bettina to introduce the overall theme of the panel.
I'm sorry.
Fine.
Kind of
it's done now. Why don't you do it? You might as well. First I'd like to welcome some familiar faces. Bettina Schmidt, of course, Secretary of the BASR and has been a couple of times on the Religious Studies Project. Jonathan Tuckett, you should all be familiar with by now, phenomenology guy. David Wilson, also a frequent but never unwelcome guest on the Religious Studies Project. But I'm pleased to welcome Fiona Bowie, who we have had briefly on, but it's the first time I've met her, so that's very good. Can we start, Bettina, maybe if you can give us a little overview of what we're talking about today and the aims of the panel.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. I approached David, or in a discussion, David and I got this idea to bring people together to think about how to study non-ordinary realities. We are, in anthropology and religious studies, looking at experience with deities, with spirits, with ghosts, or even with the demons. This conversation or this research with these entities requires a specific methodology. So David and I agreed that we bring people together who present different ways to approach it so that we can have a good overview of the diversity of methodologies to look at the study of experience, which are often what a colleague called behind the veil. And so it's not the ordinary reality as here sitting in a room or listening to conference papers or getting statistical data of ideas, but about something which is out of the normal, ordinary experience. And so we approached various different people, and our first approach was, of course, Fiona Bowie, whose work on the cognitive empathetic engagement and her article, which was published last year in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, presents a really good starting point to think about how to take this encounters with non-ordinary further. And then we opened up the call for papers for other people, and we got Jack Hunter to contribute and present a paper on his concept of para-anthropology. And then somebody from Maxine Meilleux from Harvard Divinity School approached us with asking whether she could present something on mediumship and platform mediumship. And then, of course, we had Jonathan Tuckett speaking about prejudice of non-human,
yes.
or being human. Beth Sinclair from Cambridge spoke about her research on indigo children and spiritual guides in this way. And David and I also contribute with papers about our own research.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps then the place to start is to turn to Fiona, and you were talking about the significance of these kind of experiences of non-ordinary realities in people's lives.
That's right. I've been grappling for a few years now with students and colleagues with this question of how you study things like mediumship, the afterlife, spirit possession, anomalous experiences as anthropologists, or at least as ethnographers. And we've been trying to get away from this, is it true or isn't it true, paradigm, particularly when you move into the field of which has usually been dominated by parapsychology. You find that it is very divided into by the so-called skeptics into those who work in the field with supposedly an open mind, but certainly quite rigorously and scientifically very often, and those who just can't cope with it at all and want to dismiss it. Now, anthropologists have some of these same problems. And when you look through the anthropology of religion and many of the texts that are written, you find that although it isn't quite as polemical, most the sort of dominant trend within the anthropology of religion has been actually to assume that the realities of the people they study are something that you listen to and you treat respectfully and you describe, but you then explain in some way. You explain it either biologically or sociologically, culturally, but there's a temptation to have the, although it's not stated explicitly, to the explain away. In other words, we know because of our positivist Western education that spirits don't really exist, people don't really communicate telepathically with animals, they don't really leave their bodies, whatever it might be. Therefore, here are these apparently rational people who are trying to understand and get to know and describe, how can we explain the fact that they have these strange beliefs? And it's even more acute when people study their own societies. So when you have somebody like Jack Hunter studying physical mediumship in Bristol, then it becomes even more of a challenge. How do people who are like us apparently hold such irrational beliefs? So we were trying to find a way that people who are trained ethnographically can look at these questions without immediately moving to this explain away phenomenon. That's partly because we thought it was unsatisfactory to dismiss part of what makes us human, which is religion, strange experiences, ordinary experiences which are meaningful but taboo. And partly because there's really a gap in the literature, and it's been so much self-censorship that when anthropologists have had strange experiences in the field, they've tended to exclude them from their actual ethnographic works. So this is our starting point. How do we, just trying to explore, how do we do this? And it's not hugely original, but we've tried to adopt a methodology that allows you to, what I call, make a thought experiment and act as if something were true, withholding judgment, not withholding, you're taking your brain out, not going native, but being able to suspend judgment and admit that we don't actually know how the world works, and at least not very well, only partially. And try sort of empathetically and through engaging, very often physically, somatically, so that we're learning with our body and all our senses and not just our brains through interviews and through talk, what people's experiences are. And these could actually be ordinary everyday experiences of a unitive experience, a beautiful sunset, a sense that your granny who just died actually came and visited you in the night and gave you a message. Doesn't matter what it is, but just this things which are deeply meaningful to people, but which are often hidden, but which are part of our experiences as being embodied human beings. And this opens us up to a world in which other spirits, other creatures, visible and invisible entities might be seen to be sharing a world with us. So it's quite exciting. It's not esoteric in the sense that we see these as quite natural and normal and ubiquitous experiences. So that was a starting point. I've become very interested in what David Hufford calls the experiential source. And again, there are many terms used. It's not original to David. But looking at the ways in which common experiences of the paranormal, what you might call psychic or anomalous experience, probably inform much of what has developed as religious belief, which then have all sorts of different cultural accretions. And there are some good examples of experiential source. David himself studied sleep paralysis. Doesn't mean he sees it as mystical, but he sees it as something universal, ubiquitous, which gives rise to certain religious understandings about possession, about ghosts, about spirits, witchcraft, and so on. Different interpretations, but the same experience. Near-death experiences, very often reincarnation experiences, out-of-body experiences, telepathic ESP experiences. When you drill down and look historically and culturally at the literature, at human area resource files, at ethnographic accounts from around the world, it becomes very obvious that there is a common core of experience to many of these phenomena, which at least raises interesting question of how much of what became our religions and understanding and beliefs actually relate to first-hand personal experience. And we've had many examples in this conference, like one of the last papers we had talking about Conan Doyle and Wallace, for instance, and the way that their psychic experiences informed their later interests and work. So that was another area. And then the third point I tried to cover was the transformative effect of these experiences. And they can be negative if the experience is frightening, like Paul Stoller describing being chased out of Niger by a sorcerer who sent his negative energies or spirits to bewitch him, and subsequent illness and difficulty he had in the States, which he related back to his experience in Niger. So these aren't necessarily positive experiences, but many of them are. They're transformative both for the individuals who have them and for the people who research them. So that was the third part of my lecture, was trying to look at some of the transformations that take place when we open ourselves to this encounter with non-ordinary realities.
Yeah, this transformative aspect is very interesting. Could you speak to that at all, David? Is the important thing about these the fact that they affect ordinary reality? Is that?
Well, I suppose they affect one's perception of what is ordinary.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah.
Because these realities, which we are labelling non-ordinary, are for many people perfectly ordinary. In more than one sense, possibly. They may occur in perfectly ordinary settings, for example. You know, you may have a medium sitting in the armchair in somebody's front room, channeling granny. Mm-hmm. And this might be all be perfectly normal for everyone concerned. The setting is perfectly normal for people who are not interested or not involved in that sort of practice. And some other reality is intruding or manifesting in this very ordinary setting. So realities, one person's ordinary can be another's quite incomprehensible and beyond even coping with in any way. Mm. So I suppose the transformative effect of these experiences is a way of examining the ways in which people negotiate a change, if you like, in their personal narrative mm-hmm. about reality. Mm-hmm. If you encounter something that is beyond your normal experience, you generally have two options. You can either ignore it because it's too far removed that you actually don't have any tools to handle it, or it might be sufficiently close to be able to do something with it and somehow integrate that into your existing narrative, which will have the effect of changing that existing narrative and making it something new. And so there is a transformation taking place there. And you may also be part of a community that provides you, or a dialogue that provides you with language, concepts, tools for handling this experience in a way that renders it meaningful. And that may be an extension of your existing worldview. It might be that you have to cope with the task of shifting to some new overarching understanding of reality. Mm. It might be that major for you. But you can quite see how people feel they have been transformed if they have in some way taken on the process of assimilating these experiences. Because that may also involve them in the challenge of then having to present themselves as someone slightly different to the outside world, to friends, family, colleagues, and so on. If you integrate that kind of experience into your sense of who you are and what your personal narrative is and your understanding of reality, you are, in a sense, also facing the challenge of presenting yourself as a new person.
Well, I've argued just that, actually, in the case of the UFO abductees, that mm-hmm. it's actually the transformation is actually the assimilation mm-hmm. of an experience which didn't fit the epistemology they were yep. working in before. So they had to renegotiate,
mm-hmm.
you know, how they negotiated reality. What was
Yeah, you can quite see how in shamanic traditions, for example, you have all this language about dying and being reborn. You know, there is a new person comes out at the end of that process. But it is, as you say, it's the ability somehow to manage that that transfer, that shift, that is the transformation. It's not the event itself, because it might be so strange you don't even take it on board, in which case there is no transformation. You just keep it locked in a box in the background somewhere, hoping it never comes out again. And
of course, there are examples of where the transformation happens much later,
yes,
and that earlier experience suddenly becomes significant when it wasn't before.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there are plenty of examples in the literature and the ethnographies of people trying to resist acknowledging these events, hoping they don't actually have to do anything with them and they will just fade. And recurrent examples of that strategy is just not working, because in a lot of traditions, if you ignore the spirits, for example, they just shout even more loudly until you're forced to acknowledge them in some way and do something with it. And actually, trying to blank these things out doesn't work as a strategy. Equally, you do find transformations that go part of the way but then fail. You do find people, say in a shamanic tradition, beginning to be apprenticed to an existing shaman. But at some point, maybe the process proves too much for them to handle. And they drop out of that training and go back into some more ordinary life path. I've seen that happen there are descriptions in the literature in shamanic traditions. I've seen it happen in spiritualist mediumship. People join a development circle for a while, and then the stresses of handling it all just become too much for them. So they withdraw, and sometimes they go back in again later on, sometimes mm-hmm. they don't, depending on whether they've got space for it in their lives. So there's a lot of very complex negotiating of personal and collective identities going on here. We are able to articulate this because we have the learning and we have the conversations to do it. But for people who haven't got the linguistic tools to think this sort of thing through, these processes are perhaps much more difficult because they can't get the same handle on exactly what it is that's happening.
And doesn't that relate to what Fiona was saying about, that there's a tendency to either explain it away as being a naive belief or reduce it to whatever the trendy way of looking at the world is at the time, a Freudian thing or whatever particular model you want.
And also, if someone doesn't have the
even ability, the scholars sometimes don't have the linguistic tools.
And the danger, of course, is if you're collecting accounts from people who don't have the skill to articulate it accurately, there's the danger then that it can be dismissed as untrue or unimportant or not real or something that we need not take so seriously, simply because the people who are relating those experiences aren't able to emphasise that they should be.
Yeah, that's where my work comes in, when the scholars don't have the linguistic tools, because I wanted to pick on a comment by Fiona about the reflection on what it means to be human. And what I wanted to, what I talked about in my presentation was this idea of a human prejudice, in the sense that when we go and investigate these groups, as far as these groups are concerned, spirits, gods and ghosts are other subjects which they relate to as they would to another person sitting next to them in the room. But we as scholars approaching this kind of had this prejudice where we assume that only humans can be subjects, and we assume the same should be true of these people as well. So when we approach these groups who are recognizing subjectivity in non-ordinary spaces, we then have to try and explain how it is that they've deviated from this presupposed norm. So, part of my work has been to try and get past this kind of prejudice in assuming that in order to be a subject, you have to be human.
I thought Beth Singler, the paper she just presented to us on indigo children in a New Age context, moving from seeing themselves as somebody with ADHD as a diagnosis to seeing themselves as beings from, another planet or star children or enlightened beings, was very interesting. And that the way that it's like your UFO cases, it's a retrospective redefinition of who they are and what has been pathologized then become something positive.
Absolutely.
And as Jonathan was saying, it's a way also of extending the idea of what is human to including, you know, as one of her examples, somebody who saw themselves as a sort of master of the universe from another planet, as an extreme end of that redefinition.
Mm. And I think a common theme of all the papers in the three panels was the fact that we are struggling with our concept of rationality, what Jonathan presented very well in his paper, that this has overshadowed our understanding of how we approach other religions, other cultures, and other experiences. And so my argument, what I present in my paper at the end, was that based on Michael Lambeck's work, that we should avoid this thinking there is just one concept. It's this one and not this one. So it's either A but not B, that we perhaps should embrace the diversity of solutions, that it's possible to have two solutions or three solutions or four solutions instead of just one. Mm-hmm. So to embrace really a polyphonic approach to various different realities.
Yeah, I didn't speak about this in my presentation because I was mostly criticizing his own notion of intersubjectivity, but Alfred Schutz talks a lot about rationality, and he has three postulates of rationality, and they're all framed in the sense of rationality is about problem solving. But these three postulates that you have are completely empty and useless unless you start adding additional postulates. So the use of rationality depends entirely upon additional postulates, and there's no rules to say what postulates can and can't be added. Mm. So when you go into different groups, what the rationality in terms of those postulates is always going to be the same. It's just the different postulates they've then added to give rationality its context in order for it to work in situ. The difference.
That's kind of what I was saying. The transformation is a shifting of to a form of rationality that explains the data, but it's a different rationality. Mm. We've got to take into account that it's not that there's rationality in anything that isn't that, it's deviating from it. There is no one pure form of rationality that applies to the human existence.
I think in terms of methodology as well, that variety brings in Carol Cusack's point about being, well, as she called herself, a methodological dilettante. meaning simply that she chooses between different methodologies depending on what she looks at. And that actually isn't being a dilettante, that is actually becoming very intelligent. Mm-hmm. Because different methodologies do different things. They are different tools. So, you know, one methodology might not be right for what you're looking at, because every methodology has implicit, or sometimes implicit, assumptions, presuppositions, not only as to how something should be looked at, but also as to what is worth looking at. Every methodology gives access to certain things, but it also excludes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is that need to shift between methodologies to take account of these different realities, these different transformations that are being negotiated all the time.
There's something that's occurred to me listening to the panels, these panels, but also the keynote from Leonard Primiano, and specifically relating to what Jonathan's been saying. I wonder if we're... The even more interesting thing is perhaps we're imposing a false model of... We're not only imposing a false model of what is rational on the other, but we're kind of doing it to ourselves, because actually these kind of experiences, they're the norm, really. They're incredibly widespread, and at least acceptance that they happen is far more widespread than sort of the beliefs of you know, the mainstream religions or whatever. And I'm thinking of people like Martin Stringer's work and stuff that started to bring this out, and Marion Bowman's work as well. Are we actually getting it the wrong way around?
I think we are. It kind of ties in quite broadly with my thesis as well. But going back to my comment about Fiona and the human prejudice, Fiona's application of the human prejudice is a very positive kind of application, in that humans are always the same and we have these universal experiences. Whereas if you look at, for instance, the naturalist literature, you get these very negative applications when they talk about counterintuitive agents and finding the human in the non human, and alongside that you have these grand claims by the naturalists of how great science is and how science gives you the world as it is. So there is a certain, we have a heritage of epistemic arrogance from the days in which naturalism was the dominant methodology within social science and religious studies. And I think we're starting to realize that actually we need to cut back from that arrogance a little bit and recognize that maybe we're just one among many other forms of rationality that we're all trying to figure out how they sit in relation to each other.
I mean, I do see the boundary between human and non-human is quite fuzzy and different in different contexts. It's not to say it doesn't exist. I mean, it exists biologically, but it also exists conceptually. But it is a fuzzy boundary, which is quite blurred and move in different ways to different people. And certainly when you start to look at something like spirit possession or attachment, or people who have expanded their awareness to seeing their spirit guides, or having auric fields, which are always energy fields interacting with each other, then it's very difficult to talk about bounded relationships, you know, as humans, as discrete beings. Hmm. And that's one of the fascinating things about this field of study, is that it's not that these terms don't exist conceptually and biologically, but that actually I don't think they are clearly bounded by any means. But I think you're absolutely right in that much of the discourse is actually still in relation to a form of naturalism, which wants to say this is human and all this must be excluded because it's not within our definition of what's human.
Mm.
So when using the term human being and trying to be positive and expand it, it is to some extent still in dialogue with that form of naturalism, which says no, having experience of ESP or telepathic or leaving your body or communicating with other spirits is not possible because, you know, we can't scientifically prove it.
Mm.
So it does depend on the context, I think, in which one's using those terms.
Mm. And I think that, you know, that's an old point that's been made, I suppose, but all definitions, you know, they have a limited usefulness, which is not to say they don't have usefulness, but it's always limited because every definition, in a sense, embodies a question. And definitions are more or less useful according to what they reveal,
mm-hmm.
and how they take our understanding forward. Any definition potentially has a limited shelf life until the point comes where you realise it's causing difficulties to maintain it. Therefore, you adjust it and see what else it teaches you if you shift that boundary somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one perfect definition of anything. You know, it's like watching religious studies scholars trying to define what religion is and isn't. It's a useful exercise for certain purposes, but there is actually no holy grail of a perfect definition to be found.
Well, I might disagree with you on that, because in our final panel, I put forward this idea that we should start developing a purely social scientific language, as it were. And I don't mean this in the sense that the naturalists meant it, because naturalists will develop the scientific language and then roll it out to the rest of the world. But I think in a specific context within the room of academic scholars, we can develop our own terminology and our own words to define certain things so that they make sense to us within our context. I think the problem people had with it was this was in relation to Patina's discussion of possession, and it sounded like I was trying to replace the word possession completely with another word, and we stopped talking about possession altogether, a la Fitzgerald, that we stopped talking about religion altogether. But in a sense that we have this kind of a transitory term that when someone says possession in the scientific discourse, we then use this word, which can then be related to other words, and we can then start to see more of the connections.
Yeah, I think the problem here is that you are situating the whole debate in a scientific point of view.
Yes.
But in scientific discourse, and I think what is more important that we realize there are various discourses. Scientific discourse is just one out of many. Mm. And I remember back, I think it was one of my first or second semester as a student in anthropology, to learn that what we call natural can be quite different in other cultures. In other cultures, the engagement with spirits or witchcraft is natural, and not natural would be to have an accident with a car. And so it's a totally different concept.
Well, natural's another one of those interesting words that, particularly in my discussions of phenomenology, even Husserl uses the word natural in so many different ways, in so many different times. You kind of, part of the problem is actually the English language and like the limits of the English language, that one word is being given several different purposes, and you just wish you could create new words to be a little bit more specific about this. But yes, no, I am unapologetically a social scientific hardliner in that respect. So yes, no, when you accept that there are diplomatic relations with other provinces, yes, this idea of a social scientific language certainly becomes problematic in that respect. So
I think rather than trying to find a scientific language on which we can all agree, I suspect that that's a hopeless project because human experience is so diverse. But I think that there's something to be said for finding new terminology within a political context. And, you know, we're aware that politically how some terms have fallen into disuse because they're seen as pejorative and others have been adopted. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they stick, sometimes they don't. Sometimes people will adopt these terms for themselves but not like other people to use them. As Judith Oakley wrote about travellers, whereas people call themselves gypsies, but they didn't want other people calling them gypsies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there's political sensitivities. An example which came to my mind is in my many years of teaching gender, we used to talk about gender dysphoria, and now you talk about people who are transgendered. That, obviously, is a very positive change from something which pathologizes the way some people are to being a label, a term which they can adopt for themselves, which is a better neutral description. So I'm all for trying new terminology, but I think more for political and social rather than scientific reasons.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's a completely political move. My own example, the one I raised during the paper, was the translation of the word man, which in English is quite a sexist term. And I use an old English equivalent in order to avoid the sexist connotation. So yeah, I'm thinking specifically in terms of things, words like man, which carry with them connotations that we want to avoid, and we know we want to avoid them. So we need a bit more of a discussion about, okay, we've got this problematic term, why don't we think of a new word with which to replace it, which gets rid of that connotation.
Which is fine until it acquires connotations of its own. I mean,
yes,
finding new language is only a way of taking...
We might,
things just forward, as long as not everyone adopts that new language. Because if the day ever comes when we all agree on this exactly the same terms for everything, we'd probably stop asking questions.
Unfortunately, it's time to stop asking questions. We've run out of time. We've found new terms. We've moved on from the paranormal and the supernatural onto talking about non-ordinary realities. But I think... although we couldn't do more, I think we've definitely shown that this is an area of study that has major implications for how religious studies and the studies of related phenomena is going to be moving forward in the future. So I'd like to thank all of you for taking part.
Thank you.
We've come a long way in these roundtable discussions from that first time that we gathered in this very seminar room with Kevin, Liam, Jonathan, Ethan, etc., and discuss the future of religious studies. Well, we are now that future. That roundtable that you just heard is part of that future.
The aims have got more modest, but the guests have become
more eminent.
More eminent, yeah.
And less ordinary.
Yes, indeed.
Fantastic. We should mention, of course, that we are presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions.
Indeed, and that's why it's particularly pleasing to be able to bring you four different recordings from this year's conference, of which this was just one. If you missed the interview with Leonard Primiano from a couple of weeks back, you might want to check that out, and two more still to come.
That roundtable there fits in quite nicely with quite a few other interviews that we've done. I know you mentioned last week, but I could mention the Ronald Hutton and John Wolfe interviews that you did a while back. That would fit quite nicely in there. Probably also Graham Harvey's on animism. And
Graham Harvey's is probably the most similar, I think, to this one in terms of its discussion of the methodology and the kind of epistemology of it. You should also mention, Philip Bamman from last week on witchcraft and demonic possession. Mm-hmm. And also from around this time last year, the series that we collaborated with Jack Hunter with from Esalen.
Yeah, with the paranormal.
On the paranormal, yeah. Yes, which touched on many of the same themes, and indeed Fiona Bowie was involved in that one as well. Yeah. So yeah, there's, I think in this roundtable we got a bit closer to the critical kind of approach that I would like to take with this kind of stuff. Particularly, that's why I was pushing for Jonathan to be involved in this. I think we need to be aware of the discursive construction of non-ordinary and paranormal and supernatural, as well as the discursive formations which surround the discipline, which of these things are legitimate religion and which of these are fringe interests that only I was recently described as a scholar of the weird, which I quite liked, but nonetheless, why is this a marginal thing and not, given that these phenomena, these alleged phenomena are recurrent across world religions, why is this seen as a marginal thing? So yeah, I think we've got a way to go, though. I don't want to labour this point, but I feel that this subject is riddled with insider kind of perspectives rubbing up against this discursive formation.
And we are always in that sort of awkward position as, well, particularly us who are just beginning to climb the rungs, that you might at some point have to accept, you know, if someone offered you a lectureship as, you know, and here's our person who does weird
professor
religions,
of the weird, yeah.
You would take it, but also sort of not wanting to take it at the same time, that kind of, you've almost got to accept the dominant discourse in order to subvert it, because otherwise you don't have a position. It's weird.
It is weird. Yes, indeed it is.
We were mentioning the BASR there. Another, well, I was going to say society. The Irish Society for the Academic Study of Religions. Next week we've got my third interview coming from them, but it's almost as if we're almost becoming based in Belfast at the moment, because there's another two interviews coming from me that I recorded in Belfast, and David's going to be over in November, December?
End of November, and I'm expecting to get at least two interviews there.
Yeah, so we're featuring Belfast quite heavily. This interview next week is with Owen O'Mahony, and he's a social scientist and a geographer. And his interview is on, we called it Geographies of Religion and the Secular in Ireland. And I immediately started with just, you know, could you contextualize the religious history of Ireland for us? And, you know, so he does a great job of just immediately sort of taking us from prehistoric humanity right up to the present day in a very short space of time. And Owen's been an active social media.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
Commentary. So we're glad to have that interview. On the top, so that was recorded at the Irish Association's conference back in May. On the topic of conferences, we're now already getting into that sort of crazy conference time again.
Indeed. So AAR is first, the American Association of Religion.
For the study of the American Academy of Religion.
Academy of Religion, yeah. That's it, yeah. And that's fairly soon, I think.
That is the weekend of my wedding. So it's still coming up at the end of November.
Okay, yeah.
But in any case, the SSSR, which is the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, and the American Academy of Religion conferences are both coming up very soon. And we've got a few interviews lined up. We can't talk about them, because they may not happen due to logistics.
But it looks like we're going to have at least kind of two or three from AAR and SSSR, we need to find out what's going on with Tommy, who's understandably snowed under at the moment, but I believe there's a couple of panels.
That the RSP's name might be
that the RSP's is possibly being attached to, certainly. But far more exciting than any of that is that we're going to be unveiling our new graphics.
Yay!
Our new artwork.
Yeah, which Tommy and Keenan, a pal of Tommy's who he introduced to us, have been working on. So, if you're at these conferences, keep your eye out for the RSP's flyer. If you don't see it, let us know. If you're at any conference and you think that we should have a flyer there, let us know.
I dare say we'll be putting it up somewhere on the site or the social media, and even making it available. If you're at one of these conferences, or indeed any of the any conferences in the near future, because I think we'll be using this for a while, and you see the stack of these, then please do take them and bring them back to your own institution. Let your new undergraduates and postgraduates find out about the project that way. Mm-hmm. Other ways they can find out about the project:
Facebook, of course, Twitter, Google+, mm-hmm. iTunes, the website.
Website's quite an important one. Yeah.
it really is. Although some people might never look at the website because they get it all through a podcatcher.
Yeah, or an RSS feed, like myself. Yeah. So, don't forget to drag our Amazon link into your
bookmarks bar.
The bookmarks bar, and then you can use that for no matter what it is you're buying, be that sort of replica, Civil War memorabilia, or clothing, or perhaps your Christmas presents coming up. That every time you do that, you give a little percentage of that money to the RSP at no expense to yourself, which makes it possible for us to continue doing this.
We've whittered on for quite some time now.
Yes,
so
it's a long episode.
Just, yeah, got to say the usual TFL. Transport for London.
Hashtag TFL. Yeah, goodbye.